From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, February 27th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gonna the chi, shawa, tuksuk, nusum, salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, we hear about a new multi-agency partnership between Bartlett Regional Hospital, Capital City Fire and Rescue, and the Juneau Police Department to assist people experiencing a behavioral health crisis. We chat with the University of Alaska Southeast Chancellor Dr. Aparna Palmer about the latest spring happenings on campus. And we talk with some students from the Juno String Ensembles who will be performing this Saturday, March 1st, in a night of chamber music. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we ka shuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta ka na kaya ha ane kak, gunish cheesh.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Édie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. In December 2024, a multi-agency partnership between Bartlett Regional Hospital, Capital City Fire and Rescue, and the Juno Police Department was announced to assure people in Juno experiencing a behavioral health crisis get the right care in the right setting when they need it. It's the Mobile Crisis Team. And I am joined now by one of the representatives, hopefully another representative here in just a few moments, of both Bartlett and the Fire and Rescue to discuss. Gunath Cheesh, Ha Ye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you joining us in the studio. I am with Kim McDowell from Bartlett. Hi, Kim. Wasi Iti, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks
awesome.
For having me.
And hopefully we'll be joined by Capital City Fire Rescue Chief Rich Etheridge, who seems to be running just a little wee bit behind, which is okay. So tell me a little bit about what your title is and what you do at Bartlett.
So I'm the Chief Nursing Officer, Chief Operating Officer at Bartlett Hospital. And so I'm pretty much over operations and nursing.
Okay.
There. And under that title also falls behavior health.
Is that something that you worked yourself into? Were you previously a nurse?
Yes, I've been a nurse since 2006. I actually came to Bartlett in 2015 as an emergency room nurse.
Okay.
And then worked my way up from there.
I see. Awesome. Yeah. That's cool. And so this new mobile crisis team, this mobile response unit, how did this partnership come about?
Well, we know, as everybody knows, that behavioral health is just everywhere. It's in every home, every person you meet, every practice. And also, as the community knows, that in, you know, Bartlett had to make some really hard decisions last year and looking at core and non-core services and who, what we were going to be able to financially support and what made sense. Unfortunately, behavioral health took a hit with that. We ended up closing the crisis stabilization unit as well as rainforest recovery. We've always looked at the crisis now model, which is, you know, part of the mobile crisis team going out into the community. And we just quite weren't ready to launch that yet. And Joe Mishler from CCFR was trying to do something similar. But they had trouble getting a clinician, and it's hard because they need the clinician needs oversight. by someone with similar license or higher. And so they were having kind of a challenge for anybody wanting to do that. So we always have psychiatric emergency services clinicians. That's who sees patients in our ER if they have a psychiatric emergency or behavioral health issue. So I reached out to Joe and said, well, let's see how we can figure out if you can provide some of the staff, we can provide the clinician, and let's see how we can get together and make this just a community effort, you know, and a collaboration. And then we started meeting with JPD, and the tiles and everything started falling in place. And before we knew it, we had mobile crisis response team up and going, well, a soft rollout on November 25th of last year.
I see. Okay. And so what are the responsibilities of each of the agencies involved in the partnership?
So for Bartlett Regional Hospital, we provide the clinician that rides with either the paramedic or the EMT that's on the CCFR side. And then we have JPD who does the dispatch for the mobile crisis team.
Okay. I see. That sounds good. All right. And so you mentioned it at the beginning there that we see the need in the community. But what are some of those current needs that you see that you noticed needing this sort of mobile response unit?
Goodness, I wish my clinician was here. Well, not my clinician, BRH's clinician. She's actually texted me about 15, 20 minutes ago, and she's on a mobile crisis call currently. So this team will see anybody that's having, suicidality, depression, loneliness. I mean, you know, it just runs gamut for, you know, it could be schizophrenia, it could be bipolar, someone having a manic episode. And so we see the range of just behavioral health from, you know, depression all the way to somebody who's homicidal or suicidal. And that's just the reality of behavioral health across the country, and I would imagine the world.
And I see the value in the partnership because I'm sure different teams are responding to different things at various different times. And have you noticed a rise in the number of cases on like a yearly basis?
You know, we saw it kind of highlighted, I thought, more during COVID when everybody was locked down, and we saw a lot more with adolescents during that time, I think, because there was a lot less eyes on the kiddos. You know, they're not going to school. The teachers aren't seeing them. Counselors aren't seeing them. But I think just in general, as there's still a stigma around behavioral health, but I think as it becomes less and less of a stigma to say, hey, I have a mental health problem, I need help, we're seeing those numbers rise a little bit. With mobile crisis, you know, we kind of did a soft rollout in November, didn't really tell a lot of folks that we were doing it because we didn't have all the pieces in place. They went during that time and what we call rounded or checked in on the Glory Hall and made connections with folks there. But we've already seen over, since we really started kind of looking at the numbers since, you know, January timeframe, over 60 calls for behavioral health emergencies. And only 5 of those have been needing to be transported. They were able to get support at their house or wherever they're living to be able to maintain or handle that behavioral health emergency where they were at. So it's really great if this team can meet people where they are, which, you know, helps the person that's in that crisis feel more in control, because they're not being taken out of their environment and brought into an emergency department if that's not needed.
I see. And so how does it work? Does the JPD see something that's going on and then call the mobile crisis unit, or can people call the mobile crisis unit directly? How does it work?
So so the community at large can't just call mobile crisis directly. If someone's having a behavioral health emergency or crisis and they need mobile crisis response, they can call 911 and that JPD can dispatch that team to them. Or they can also call 988, which is the care line, which gets them connected with a clinician immediately. And then they can in turn call our dispatch to be able to have our team go out.
I see. So 988 is a line that goes directly to Bartlett, the clinicians at Bartlett?
No, so the 988 is the national, basically, care line for mobile crisis. So you can, like a suicide hotline, you dial 988, a clinician answers, and then they can help that person immediately if that person wants to talk to somebody right away. And when they're talking to that clinician, they can reach out to our local 911 or local police department and let them know that this person's in crisis and needs the team.
Oh, absolutely. That's great. Because, of course, I think many people know of 911 because it's been instilled in our brains for decades and whatever it is. But 988, I hadn't heard that before. Yeah. So that's really good to know.
So, yeah, either one of those numbers they'll be able to get mobile crisis dispatched.
So the mobile response unit, when are those particular services available?
So right now those hours are from 9 in the morning to 6 at night. And it's 7 days a week. We kind of modeled this out of the mobile crisis response teams that they have in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. And that's kind of what they started their hours at. And then they saw what the need was before or after and then adjusted accordingly. So we're currently tracking how many calls come in before and after the mobile crisis team starts and ends to determine if we need to shift those hours at all, just depending on the volume. So we're currently tracking those calls.
I see. Yeah. I was going to say, because crisis doesn't understand a time limit, right?
Absolutely right. Yeah.
So right now it's from 9 to 6. Obviously, you can call the 988 number anytime or 911 at any time.
Right, and that is correct.
Somebody will respond. But in terms of this particular unit, and so this unit is two people that go out. Like you said, I know Catherine Ferris, who's a behavioral health technician, mm-hmm. was maybe going to join us today, but texted you right before the show and said, hey, I'm on a call.
Right.
And got a call. So that's what happens, right?
Right.
So is it, so you said it's a clinician and then somebody from CCFR, paramedic?
Yes, either a paramedic or EMT.
Okay. And they respond to the call depending upon what they think the need is for that particular team?
Correct.
Okay. Because sometimes it may not need that. Maybe it's something just like needs to send an EMT in, right?
And so when someone calls in and say they call the 911, you know, call 911 and they say, I have this situation and, you know, then the dispatchers, we have worked with JPD and their leaders to do a protocol and an outline of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. We obviously don't want our clinicians going to calls where someone's like actively suicidal with a weapon, because that is a little bit harder to manage, right? That's too much safety risk for everybody there. So we navigate with JPD as best we can on those calls. If EMS goes on a call and they show up to the scene and they said this is not medical, this is clearly a behavioral health issue, then the EMS team can call mobile crisis and say, I think this is more of a mobile crisis call, and then mobile crisis will go to that. And the same way with JPD.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And again, this is the mobile response unit that's a partnership between Bartlett, the JPD, and the fire team, CCFR. And it is available through calling 988 and or 911, and they will figure out if the mobile response unit is needed in that particular situation.
Right.
So that's really good. So if someone is assisting a family member or knows someone who's in crisis, what should they do before the mobile team responds, or if the mobile team isn't available outside of the hours that you currently have?
Yeah, and so if someone's experiencing or their family's experiencing a behavioral health emergency or crisis and the mobile team is not available, if it's outside of these hours, they're always welcome to bring those folks to the emergency department.
I see. Okay. At Bartlett.
At Bartlett,
yeah,
correct.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. It's such a great service to be providing to Juno in it's fantastic, right? Yeah. It's just a really cool service. And how many team members are there right now?
So on the clinician side, we have a total of 5. Okay. And that allows sometimes to have double coverage during the day, because currently, unlike the models in Fairbanks and Anchorage, RPS clinician is also shared with the emergency department. So if somebody comes in by private vehicle to the emergency department, and there's only one clinician on, it'll be that clinician with the mobile crisis team that will go and be dispatched to the ER to see that patient that walked in.
I see. Okay. And you had mentioned at the beginning that like rainforest recovery was unfortunately had to be shut down. Mm-hmm. You have 5 clinicians now and this mobile response unit. Do you see an opportunity for growth there again in terms of maybe getting something like the recovery center back into existence?
You know, I think that's a difficult question, because there's definitely a need. And what we look at is funding, you know, which is, you know, what everybody across the country is looking at, especially now with the new administration coming in, trying not knowing what's going to happen with any budget cuts or any funding to Medicaid. And so it's really comes down to funding and reimbursement to try to support those programs. And so, you know, this was born out of that, knowing that there was a need in our community. And it's a great privilege to be able to do this with Juneau Police Department and CCFR.
Absolutely. That's so cool. It's the mobile crisis team. You can access it via 988 as the phone number or 911, and they will dispatch that team. It's available between 9 and 6, 7 days a week currently. Is there anywhere online that we can find out more information about the team in particular, or this unit in particular?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if we've actually put it on our BRH website or not. We've done a couple of advertisements for it here and there, and we haven't quite put it on our social media yet. It's a little bit different as far as because the community can't just access it like they would, you know, a doctor's appointment, right? They have to go through 911 or 988 to have the team dispatched.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's good to know about, right? And it's more of an awareness campaign than a website, really.
Right. That's and if
really
they go and just Google mobile crisis or crisis now model, it's all over the place. I mean, it's in pretty much every state. And so we follow the same model as that with the crisis now model being that we're starting with our crisis response team first. That responds and meets people where they are.
I see. Okay. Very cool. Well, Kim, thank you so much. Kim McDowell from Bartlett. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, Catherine wasn't able to join us, and it seems like Chief Rich Etheridge also wasn't available. So that's fine. Things happen, right?
Things happen.
But I really appreciate you coming on the show and telling us all about it. Of course, you can find out more about Bartlett at bartletthospital.org, or you can go to juno.org/fire or juno.org/police. For links to the various different organizations that are involved. Really appreciate you being here. And I do want to mention this, that even if – I know we mentioned the hours 9 to 6, but I think it's just really important that people remember that 988 number is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It will connect you with someone who can get you or somebody that you're assisting some help.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much. I'm Gwyneth Cheese for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Up next, a chat with University of Alaska Southeast Chancellor Dr. Aparna Palmer. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO. But first, this week's Our Living Lands from Native Voice One.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez, and this is Our Living Lands. Climate change is causing more floods across the globe. In Oklahoma, that flooding has an outsized impact on indigenous communities. KOSU and OPMX's Sarah Lisi reports on how the Oto Missouri tribe in the northern part of the state is working to mitigate those threats.
Every year, the Oto Missouri tribe and its seven clans host their annual encampment, which is
their homecoming, the reunion of the tribe and your families. It all takes place at the same place. You go down there and you bring your little kids into the arena.
That's Eric Payne, an Oto Missouri elder and former chairman of the tribe's encampment committee. More than a century's worth of encampments have happened on the tribe's grounds in Red Rock.
So we have adoption ceremonies, naming ceremonies. There's a ceremony of becoming friends, but the way it was told to me was all of those ceremonies were all supposed to be taken care of down there.
But the tribe's sacred gathering place is at risk because of the growing threat of flash flooding, and that threat is expected to increase. In 2023, a research team at the University of Oklahoma found indigenous communities in the state face higher flooding and rainfall risk.
We have had so many times a storm come in. I don't recall the campgrounds ever flooding during one of our dances, but I know we've had several close calls.
Payne explained that when the water in the creek hits the crest line, it flows across the encampment grounds and
everything in there becomes very damaged. It washes out where they've had to go in and make major repairs to the grounds.
In addition to the flooding, Payne has noticed the shrinking of different animal populations, such as the red-headed woodpecker. The tribe's emergency manager, James LeClaire, also noted the depletion of natural resources from the time when he was a kid.
Back then, you could survive on the land, such as pulling stuff, berries and stuff from trees.
But now times are different. One path forward is using the tribe's traditional ecological knowledge, or TEK. Wichita elder and researcher Teresa Sudol helped with that 2023 OU research study. She also proposed the TEK system to MIT and secured a fellowship to help the Oto Missouri tribe restore the land.
We should be able to go back to how we balanced initially our relationships with our environments and how it looked like when it was pristine and beautiful, and it took careful, tended respect and relationships. And those were taught to us from our ancestors.
Sudol aims to create what she calls a thrive map to preserve the tribe's TEK and implement it to cultivate a healthy environment. So far, the tribe has found some success with a high wind tunnel, where LeClaire is growing greens for the community.
We grew mustard greens, spinach, dark leaf lettuce, and collard greens, which they just blossom them. So this year we're trying squash, tomatoes. We've got okra growing. I've tried a bean in there to try to help it with pollination.
He also plans to bring 8 honey beehives to the community in the coming months to pollinate the area. And to prevent flooding and limit the creek's erosion, he's installed riprap, consisting of a layer of stones placed along the stream bank. Despite the steps forward, Payne wonders if the damage will be too much to recover from.
That's just, I think, human nature that we wait until it's too late, then we try to say we're sorry, let me fix that. And sometimes it's just too late.
But LeClaire is not giving up hope. In fact, he's been helping other tribal nations across Turtle Island secure grants to help their local environments.
Everything takes time, but now they're starting to see the need. You know, we need to think about our kids and our grandkids, what kind of world we're going to leave them.
LeClaire says he hopes these environmental efforts continue to grow. That means sacred sites to Indigenous communities continue to be protected. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. I'm joined now by University of Alaska Southeast Chancellor Dr. Aparna Palmer. Gunath Chi, Sha'ye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. And I misspoke. I'm actually supposed to say Gunath Chi, Sha'ye Gudi, which is the singular form of it's such a pleasure to have you here. So thank you so much, Gunath Chi, Wasa Iti. How's it going, Dr. Palmer?
Good. Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me here. Gunath Chi to you as well.
Of course, yeah. And we have so much to discuss and to talk about. Where shall we begin?
Well, I'm excited to talk about our new behavioral health program. We are offering both a BA and a BS degree in behavioral health starting this fall at UAS.
Well, we were just talking about behavioral health because of the mobile response unit that is a partnership between the fire department, the police department, and the hospital, which is very cool. And I'm glad to see that there is a program that people can take and study. What's the difference between the BA and the BS?
So the difference is, you know, in the type of preparation and the coursework that you take, but the outcome is also different. So if you get a BA, a Bachelor of Arts in Behavioral Health, you can go into roles such as counseling, clinical psychology, social services. It prepares you for careers in those disciplines. The BS, the Bachelor of Science, is more science-focused, and it would enable you to go on in healthcare fields such as medicine and allied health programs. So in one kind of degree program, as you sort of branch out and kind of decide what you want to focus on, you have two pathways that you can pursue.
Interesting. Okay. And when does that begin?
So that can begin in the fall. The Board of Regents just approved it, and it is really part of our commitment to local workforce needs. We really think this is an important area for us to fill both in Southeast Alaska and in Alaska. And actually, the Department of Labor here in Alaska projects a 21.4% increase in jobs in this area very quickly by 2026.
Wow. Well, that's what I was just talking about with the previous guest in terms of the need you know, the need as it arises further in terms of the number of cases or the number of people. And it's good to see that there's opportunity or a program that people can explore to be of assistance and help in this area.
Well, I think it's extremely important. And what I didn't mention is that it's called integrative behavioral health. And so we're looking at a lot of different perspectives, and it's very cutting edge. It's something that a lot of institutions are moving towards in the country, where you just, you know, look at the person more holistically and really help them with their well-being, with their health, with their mental health, in an approach that really incorporates all the different sides of who they are.
So where do the professors come from for this particular program? Is it new professors, or is it people who are already at the university working in a different way?
Well, actually, we did not have to hire any new professors for this program. We have an amazing professor who will be our program lead. Her name is Sarah Nico. Many of you might know her because it's a small community. She is one of our assistant professors, and she's in behavioral health sciences. She has advanced degrees in medicine, health science, and psychology. And so she's the perfect person to lead this program. And she does have some help from a local health provider who will help teach those courses. So
awesome.
We really were able to add this with existing courses so that we can serve the community.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Okay. That's the behavioral, a new integrated behavioral health program, BA or BS. What else is on the docket?
Well, I wanted to highlight a couple of really cool opportunities that University of Alaska students have, and they have to do with something that I think is really important now, which is participating in policymaking and really understanding what legislatures do. And so we have our Ted Stevens Legislative Internship Program. It is actually led by a professor here at UAS, but it's open UA-wide to students from all over the system. And these students actually get to intern with a legislator this semester. They earn credits for their degrees, but they also get stipends that cover their housing and travel.
Oh.
So it's a chance to learn how to do policymaking, or to learn, you know, how a legislative office works. So this year we have about 14 interns, and 5 of them are actually from UAS. So we're very, very proud of the participation of our students.
Wow.
There's also the federal equivalent. So for UA students who would really like to spend a summer in Washington, D.C., working with our federal relations team and really getting to know our federal legislators, this is an outstanding internship program. It's completely paid. They pay for the flights. They pay for the housing. And students can receive credit for it as well. So, 2 outstanding programs that University of Alaska students, and especially UAS students, can take advantage of.
Awesome. Now, I do want to mention, we should talk about the Board of Regents and recent decisions that they've made and comments that they've made about various different things and websites and DEI and all that. So how do we want to approach that?
Well, you know, rather than commenting or trying to summarize the board's view, which is described in the motion, what I want to talk about is how UAS is responding to that. So I want people to know that we are sticking to our core values. Our core values include compassion, care, creating a welcoming environment for our students, but also our employees, and making sure that everybody has a sense of belonging. So we are continuing to try to understand the needs of every student, offer them personalized learning and support, and working to continue making our institution more capable of meeting their needs. We really believe in that, and we are going to continue doing that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great.
And the other thing that I really want to mention is that, you know, I've had people ask me questions about our Alaska Native programs and our Indigenous Studies programs, they are all intact. We are going to continue offering those programs because they are important to the state of Alaska and they are important to the people of Alaska. And the board is very supportive of that. We are also going to continue to offer disability services. So even though the board responded to the federal directive in terms of DEI, as an institution, we are going to continue to be non-discriminatory. We're going to make sure that people feel safe and welcome on our campuses.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, thank you. And quickly, just want to make sure everyone knows that we are preserving the principles of academic freedom, which is really important to me as a former faculty member, as well as the freedom of expression for both our students and for our employees. I read an article today on K2, and just want to make sure that everyone knows I am completely in support of academic freedom.
Absolutely. That's good to hear. And so all those things are fantastic. And of course, I have to ask you something about your marine biology background. And so I always get a little lesson each time when we talk about the polychaetes or the tardigrades, the sea worms and the water bears. And the thing I was thinking about this time around was that tardigrades are capable of cryptobiosis.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh my gosh. See, you have me with goosebumps because I get so excited. So cryptobiosis is a stage of dormancy that some animals can do in response to harsh environmental conditions. And tardigrades are so interesting because they can go into dormancy because of decreasing moisture. Remember, they're aquatic organisms, but when their habitats dry up, they can go into this dormant state. They can do it in response to high pressures, high salinities, depending upon where they live. This is a way in which they can survive those harsh environmental conditions until conditions are better. One of the most exciting things that I was able to do in my career as a professor was work on tardigrades, which, remember, are aquatic organisms. They live in freshwater and in marine environments. Mm. I worked on the ones that live in the high elevation deserts of western Colorado. So for much of the year, these organisms are in a dormant state. They roll themselves up into a ball called a tun, T-U-N, and then they are able to, like, lose over 90% of their water. They stay in the state until they get a little bit of rain. And then when it rains, they live in these mosses. The mosses become plump with water. They absorb the water. They come out of their dormancy. They just sort of amble about, do all of their daily functions. And then as the moss dries up, because it is a desert, they slowly go back into their dormancy. So amazing, amazing organisms. This is why they could fly these tuns into the vacuum of space, bring them back, and the tardigrades were still able to come out of their dormancy.
That's amazing. I was reading an article about it, and they were talking about how they had found some tardigrades in a crustaceous amber from many moons ago. And the article was like, the way they survived it was sleeping through it, which is kind of how I survived college.
Well, we got to survive whatever way we can.
Dr. Aparna Palmer, I really appreciate it. Chancellor of UAS, thank you so much for the information on those exciting programs and for academic freedom.
Thank you. I so appreciate it. Gunoschish again to you,
yeah.
And have a great day.
Gunoschish to you as well. Okay. Next up, we'll be talking with the Juno String Ensembles. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO, but first, a savory moment.
Step into the savory moment. If you're a fan of seafood and Cate Blanchett, your eyes were glued to the screen in episode 2 of the psychological miniseries Disclaimer. Main character Catherine Ravenscroft is preparing an elegant dinner for her husband while treachery simmers on the back burner. We're pretty sure the husband has been deceived. Absolute truth in this thriller about a celebrated journalist and her inky mire of a past is not on the menu. What does show up is Sol Mounier. It's not poison that Catherine Ravenscroft is adding to the fish, but mere butter and lemon juice. And it's a delight to watch this woman at her cooking craft, holding emotion at bay while deftly sliding tender, silken meat from its bones. You can almost taste those creamy flakes melting between your teeth, washed down by the sharp tang of icy white wine. In an interview, Blanchett reveals she took deboning lessons before shooting this scene. Here is the technique she learned for a whole butterfly cut fish. With the cooked fish flesh side up, use a knife to cut down the center line where the spine is. Use a fork to hold one half of the fish in place while pushing the other half away from the spine with your knife. Repeat. Now the vertebrae and all those pointy little pin bones are revealed. Carefully lift out the skeleton and secret it away. Reposition flesh to hide the omission. When her husband fails to show up for dinner, he's had it with his wife, no matter how good of a cook she is. That beautifully prepared meal is scraped into the dustbin. Your heart will sink. How does disclaimer end? You're pretty sure Catherine Ravenscroft is a liar, but Blanchett's facial expressions are so calculated, you might be left with mixed feelings. By the time the series ends, skeletons are firmly back inside the closet. Find the link to a fish deboning lesson at savorymoment.org from the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska. I'm Beth Short Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This Saturday, March 1st, Juno String Ensembles presents Chamber Music Night. It's at 7 p.m. at Kunekhidi Northern Light United Church. Pay as you can, tickets at the door, or you can purchase ahead on their website at junostringensembles.org. The ensemble is made up of two larger ensembles, the Ursa Major and the Aurora Strings. And I am joined in this studio now by some members, some student musicians to share their story and more about this event, as well as parents in the background with cameras and videos and ready to getting it all captured on this. So I'm welcoming to the studio now Zev, who's eighth grade student and part of Aurora Strings, Arlo, who's a ninth grade student, part of Aurora Strings, and Tate, who's an eighth grade student, part of Aurora Strings and Ursa Major. Doubling up there, and you all are going to be doing a very cool performance, which we'll be talking about here in just a second. But Gunth Chish, EID, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you all in here today. Wasa Iti, how's it going, Tate?
Pretty good.
All right, Wasa Iti, how's it going, Zev?
Not too bad.
Awesome. And Arlo, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Awesome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. You have your violins, and we're going to be playing here in just a little bit. But let's first start with, tell me a little bit about the Aurora Strings Ensemble, because all of you are a member of the Aurora Strings Ensemble. Is that right?
Yes. Zev?
Yeah. So, Zev, tell me a little bit about Aurora Strings and how you got involved.
Well, my teacher, Mr. Shaw, he's the conductor for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he just helps out with almost everything. And, teaching, conducting.
Yeah.
Helping people get up to the level they need to be for high school performance, all state, that sort of thing.
Awesome. And how long have you been playing?
5 or 6 years.
5 or 6 years. And how did you get into it?
My parents.
Which one over here is your parent?
That one
right there?
Yeah.
I see. And said, hey, so how old were you when you started?
Because
how old are you now?
I'm 13.
13. So six years ago, you were like seven?
Seven, yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. And do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I think it's really fun.
And what has been the most rewarding experience so far playing in the ensemble?
definitely like meeting all the different people mm-hmm. in the different ensembles.
I see. Okay. And do you have a favorite piece of music?
No, I like all of them.
Do you? They're all great. Have you learned, like, are you playing mostly classical music?
Yeah. Okay. But we also do like show scores from movies and fiddle music.
Right. There's okay.
Lots of different varieties.
Yeah, it's kind of fun because most of the music these days that are scores of movies would have been what the composers did, you know, hundreds of years ago. So they just didn't have video to put it to, which is kind of cool. And Arlo, what about you? You're a member of the Aurora Strings. How long have you been playing?
I've been playing for about 9 years, so since first grade.
First grade. And how did you get involved?
So at some of the elementary schools, there's a program called JAM, Juneau, Alaska Music Matters.
Okay.
And it helps introduce young people to playing the instruments.
Product of JAM, a wonderful program here in Juneau. That's really cool. And do you have a favorite piece of music?
Yeah. My favorite piece that we're playing is Waltz No. 2 by Shostakovich.
Okay. All right. And so this is all happening on Saturday night. It's March 1st. It's going to be over at the United Church, Northern Light United Church. And it's going to be a nice program. Are both of the ensembles, are you all playing together or do you play separately first? I know this is actually a night of chamber music, though. So is it breaking down those ensembles into smaller groups?
Yeah, so both ensembles are playing separately, and there's a few smaller quartets and a double quartet playing there.
Okay, and I know you're going to be playing a piece, the three of you together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which you're going to share a little bit with us today. Yeah?
Yep.
Awesome. Okay. And Tate, you're a member of both ensembles.
Yes,
how does
I am.
That work?
So I started off last year as a member of Ursa Major, and this year I got into Aurora Strings just because you have to play a year of Ursa Major first before you get into Aurora Strings.
Okay.
So just the transition over to the higher level orchestra, and I'm right in the middle of the transition.
So is Ursa Major for younger folks?
Ursa Major is for the younger, earlier violin players.
Okay,
and, cello.
And then Aurora Strings is a little bit more advanced. Do you play?
Aurora Strings is the more advanced orchestra, and it's like the second level of Ursa Major.
So why are you holding on to the lollipop of the Ursa Major? What are you doing there? What are you doing in both?
Because it's still fun to meet the people in Ursa Major and play with them.
Ah, I see. So it's about the people. So once they graduate up, maybe you'll let that one go. Or do you age out of it or no?
Yeah, over time you move up and you kind of leave Ursa Major to the other younger violinists. And
I see you staring at Dad over here for some of the answers, which is fine. Yeah. No, that's all good. But you're going to eventually, you'll leave that particular group.
Yeah, I will. I'll move on probably next year to move up to just Aurora Strings.
Aurora Strings. And how long have you been playing?
I've been playing probably 7 or 8 years.
Wow.
Started
that's a long time.
Also with JAM at Glacier Valley.
Okay, cool. Also, all products of, well, not you necessarily, Zev. You haven't been in JAM before.
No, I haven't done JAM or Prelude.
I see. Okay. Now, do you all only play the violin at this moment?
We all play the violin, but we all have other instruments that we play, too.
Oh, like what do you play, Tate?
I can also play bass guitar, and I play a little bit of cello.
Cello. What about you, Zev?
I don't play any other instruments.
Okay, and Arlo?
Yeah, I play the guitar mostly and also bass guitar.
Bass guitar. Okay, so let me go down the line again because I'm really curious about this. Now that you've had, well, between you, you've had a couple decades of experience, but each of you has had at least, you know, 5 years, 6 years of experience, and some of you more. What do you think the future holds for you in terms of music? We'll start with you, Tate.
I feel like I could continue on and play higher and higher up until you can get to like the symphony and other orchestras throughout like the western side of the U.S. You can play with larger orchestras with the best players across.
So you're interested in continuing on in terms of classical music or
yeah, classical music, fiddle music, all the different scores you can play. I want to learn a lot of music.
Because when you mentioned bass guitar, I actually think bass players are the coolest people ever. In any band, I always think the bass player has it going on. Do you have designs on being part of a band or playing other genres of music?
I don't know. I just started bass not too long ago. Mm-hmm. Probably been playing it for 6 months.
I see.
Yeah, so I know a few pieces and music but I don't know too much on it yet.
I see. I got you. That makes sense. Absolutely. Okay, Zev, what about you? What are your plans for thinking about in terms of the future of you in music?
Well, I definitely want to play like a high school orchestra, and I mean, if I can beyond that, but I'm not really sure.
I see. Do you have, I guess this is a, I'll ask this question in a second. And then Arlo, what about you? Do you have designs on playing music continuing on?
Yeah, I'm working on moving up to the Juno Symphony. I know there's a few people in Aurora Strings who are playing for the symphony, and this year I actually went to All-State Orchestra in Anchorage, and looking forward to continuing that.
Awesome. And now you said you also play the bass.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have designs on other genres of music? I'm trying to find the next rock star here.
Yeah, I actually have my own band, and we just won the high school talent show last night.
Well, see, that's what I'm talking about right there. Okay, cool. That's fun. Won the high school. What did you play to win the talent competition?
We played Cherub Rock by the Smashing Pumpkins and Say It Ain't So by Weezer.
Ah, nice. Some very cool tunes. And Zev, I know you said you don't play any other instruments, but do you have designs on some other genres of music?
Well, I always thought that playing the drums was really cool.
Okay, so there you go.
Maybe sometime later.
Right, right,
I'll join
right.
Arlo's band.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, because I wonder too, like in terms of, I know you have music stands and so you understand how to read music, right? Is that, yep. Do all of you know how to read music?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you, there's also, I know folks have like careers in, you know, composition or in terms of learning or being a conductor eventually, something like that. Is it something that you could potentially think about studying later on, like in college at all? We're so young. We don't need to think about college yet, right? Or no? Do you think about it?
Not too much, but college would be cool.
Yeah, college would be cool. College is cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Very cool. Okay, so tell me a little bit about this piece that you're going to be playing on Saturday.
The piece we'll be playing, it's called Bugler's Holiday by Leroy Anderson. And originally it was composed for three trumpets, but we're playing an arrangement for three violins and an orchestra.
That's so cool. That's the other thing I was going to say about when you said rearrange, it made me think about that because I know there's some bands who they're classical musicians. They're trained that way. I think they've come to town a couple times, but they do like rock songs with their violins and things like that. Have you heard some of those groups before?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. There's one I listened to a few times called Simply Three.
Simply Three.
Yeah.
They went
to their concerts.
They came here a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah, they've come and performed at the schools for us.
Oh,
like,
nice.
They'll perform for the elementary schools, help get them into string instruments.
Right. And were you all part of the Kyla Thade dance party that came through? Did they come and do any workshops with y'all at your schools? Or maybe they were working with elementary schools.
I think they were probably working with elementary schools.
With the Young's kids. Okay, yeah. That's kind of cool. Okay, so and you're going to be playing that piece, the Bugler's Holiday by Leroy Anderson. Do we know anything about Leroy Anderson?
I haven't really looked into him, but I don't know much.
Okay. So tell me about this piece. What do you like about this piece?
I like how different our parts. We each start the verses of the piece. Mm-hmm. Like there's different verses to the piece, and we each have turns starting that verse, and we follow after the person who starts it.
Oh,
so just
I see.
The following of it makes it sound pretty cool.
Okay, and how long have you been working on the piece?
We've been working on this piece for about 2 months now as a trio.
And how do you find it? How do you begin when you like start working on a piece? What do you look for in terms of like, is it are you examining the sheet music and trying to figure out like the tempo? Or I'm not much of a musician, so I'm just curious where you begin.
Yeah, when we're starting a piece, we first just do like a playthrough, and then we go back and like look at what we missed or other dynamics and bow markings and.
Bow markings.
Yeah.
What is that?
There's different bow techniques, like staccato, where you play really short or other things like that. So.
And is that indicated on the sheet music? Or is that something that you start to discover as you're figuring out the composition for yourself?
Yeah, it's included with the piece, but there's different parts in it where you add in different bow techniques and stuff to make your the way you're playing it sound more unique to your group.
That's really cool. I love that. We're talking with some students from the Juno String Ensembles. They're performing this Saturday, March 1st. It's a night of chamber music, and it's going to be a combination of both the Ursa Major and the Aurora Strings Ensembles. And they come together and they do this concert, and it's really good. And Juno String Ensembles, they look to help the youth through education, travel, and performance. So do you get to travel with the groups?
Last year in May, we actually went to Sitka and did a workshop there. And
oh, nice.
Played with the symphony over there and planning a couple other trips.
So. Yeah. Do you do like fundraisers and such to make all that happen, or how does that work?
At some of the symphony performances, we put on a bake sale and play in the lobby to raise some funds for the group.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, that's great. And I see a note here that 21 pieces will be performed this Saturday, including classical, fiddle, movie, and rock music. What are some of the movie scores you're working on, Zeb?
I think those are more in Ursa Major.
Oh, well, let's talk to Tate. Yeah.
So we're playing Mission Impossible.
Oh, nice.
So that's the movie piece we're going to be playing. And then there's just a piece called Fill in the Blanks. That's just kind of more of a rock beat tempo for the piece.
Okay. That's awesome. Well, let's hear, are we going to hear Bugler's Holiday? Is that what we're going to play, or are you playing something else?
We're playing Bugler's Holiday.
You're going to play it for us. All right. Well, why don't you step up to those microphones, your stands. I'll get switched up here. I'll remind everybody what's happening as well in terms of that. And let me make sure that we can hear you up there. Give me a little note so I can make sure I got you all in there. Yeah, there we go. That's what I'm talking about. Got a little reverb on there too, which will make it sound pretty nice. And this is Bugler's Holiday. Do you guys have a name as a trio yet? Have you created a name for yourselves?
No, not yet.
You got to come up with a name. All right, so this is Bugler's Holiday from Zev, Arlo, and Tate performing this Saturday with the Juno String Ensembles during Chamber Music Night. Take it away, boys. That's what I'm talking about. Arlo, Tate, and Zev, who don't have a name yet, but we're going to create one. What is that? ATZ. There you go. ATZ Trio right there. Thank you so much. I really appreciate y'all coming in and playing. And that is the Juno String Ensemble. They'll be playing Chamber Music Night Saturday, March 1st at 7 p.m. at the Kunekidi Northern Light Church. Pay as you can, or tickets at the door. Or no, pay as you can tickets are at the door, or you can purchase in advance on their website at junostringsensemble.org. Thank you so much, Gunnar the Cheese, for being here today. And that will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, Taku Wins from Juno Community Bands, Tlingit Naida's upcoming CERT program, and Sigla has a full calendar of events planned in March. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Akbe 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at kto.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnar the Cheese, and have a joyous Juno evening.